This week, the Dow Jones Industrials finished at yet another 120-year-plus record high. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Gold Seek Radio. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend with another infotainment-rich program with two more top guest interviews. So let's think back for a moment to the year 2011. Gold more than doubled its 1980s peak of $850, soaring to within earshot of $2,000 an ounce. Silver touched its 1980s peak, but then was knocked down 50% and even more. What stopped gold and silver? Did the powers that be collude vis-a-vis a coordinated takedown to preserve the currency status quo? Just as Bitcoin and related digital currencies are out of control right now, could we see something similar in just the next 3 years? My first guest this week thinks so. He agrees that they temporarily halted the precious metals bull, but the new advance may be unstoppable. David McIlvaney, CEO of McIlvaney Financial Companies, returns with his latest inspirational, motivational book, The Intentional Legacy. He says that in the next 3 to 5 years, perhaps as soon as 2020, we'll see brand new record highs in the gold and silver market. Then Bill Murphy from Gotta.org rejoins the show, joins me in a discussion on the precious metals, including China, which is poised to consume 1,000 metric tons of gold this year alone, an increase of 50%. He's also watching the bullish technical position for a move in gold to $1,500 and silver $26 an ounce. And Goldseek Radio is pleased to have Silvercorp as a new sponsor of the show, ticker SVM. They've recently announced a 35% boost in their dividend. And for transparency's sake, Goldseek and related employees may or may not own shares in the company, including Peter Spina is looking for an opportunity to accumulate shares in SVM. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his must-hear report. And we'd like for you to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter. We continue to outperform the markets with some of the best stocks in every sector. So if you'd like to, if you haven't yet already signed up, you can do so through PayPal or your credit card. Click the links and we'll send over your personalized login information. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals sector after gold briefly touched a multi-month high of $1,300. Traders booked profits this week amid U.S. dollar weakness in anticipation of next week's rate hike at the FOMC meeting. The yellow metal gave back, though, just $9, less than 1% at $1,271 an ounce, while silver fell just 30 cents, about 2%, finishing at $1,722. The precious metals XAU shares picked up $1.15, ending at $84.37, while black gold pulled back 2, off 4%, ending at $45.83. The top story impacting the sector this week, traders' focus turned to the FOMC meeting slated for June 14th. The current Fed funds futures indicate near 100% odds of a quarter point rate hike, which will almost certainly be the last of this year. Currently, there's only 50-50 odds of one more rate hike in May of next year. In related news, on Thursday, the European Central Bank economic ministers agreed to hold the European Central Bank's rates steady. Elsewhere, news from the UK, Prime Minister May lost the parliamentary majority just days before the Brexit negotiations with the European Union. Neither the Conservative nor the Labour Party hold a majority. The UK Prime Minister Theresa May will attempt to form a minority government. The news added to the safe haven trade amid increased geopolitical uncertainty. Precious metals bottom line. Well, the technical condition remains solid for both gold and silver, which are carving out highly bullish inverted head and shoulders patterns. If this comes to pass, we should see $1,500 an ounce on gold and $26 silver. However, the CRB continues to remain problematic. If commodities cannot find a floor in the next week or so, I suspect this could change the trajectory of the precious metals. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies hovered over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors rotated out of high-flying tech companies in favor of better relative valuations in energy, materials, and financials. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones Industrials did carve out an all-time record weekly close at up 66 for the week at 21,272. The S&P, though, fell 7 points, finishing at 24,32, while the NASDAQ ended off 97 at 62,07. Although it was a tough week in the technology sector, tech stocks do remain higher by nearly 20% for the year. The Bitcoin ETF was off 45 to 455, just 9%, while the Komodo ICO touched $1.40, up 50% in just 1 week. Ticker KMD. Elsewhere, small caps were among the top gainers this week as high rates tends to negatively impact their competitors, the larger corps, which have greater global exchange rate exposure. According to one media source, Helmreich & Payne added about $3, up about 6%. Rig operator Transocean added 40 cents, 5% at $8.81 a share. Bottom line on equities. The technical outlook softened a bit this week. While our 7-indicator greed to fear index still shows few, if any, signs of frothiness, we can see a lot of indecision on the part of market participants. It looks that it'll be merely turbulence on the path to clearer skies. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Today's guest suggests that everyone must take a more proactive approach to living and back-engineer their lives. David McIlvaney, President CEO of McIlvaney Financial Companies, Director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold, and author of the new tome, The Intentional Legacy, a lot of interesting press and very positive feedback. Welcome back, David McIlvaney.
Hey, great to be with you.
I like this idea of back engineering, some of the more intriguing devices and things of that nature we use every day are the result of back engineering. And you seem to have a plan here to help us all improve our welfare. Please tell us more.
Well, absolutely. So the idea of the intentional legacy is that you look at the legacy that you're leaving. And the reality is every one of us will leave a legacy. The quality of that legacy is a completely different topic. And I think you can improve the quality of the legacy you are creating. If you look at it from a design standpoint, as you say, is you reverse engineer and say, well, what is it that you're trying to create? You know, I mean, if you're thinking of, you know, let's say an Einstein who said, yeah, I probably use 10% of my brain capacity. Well, wow. If he only used 10% of his brain capacity, I must use virtually nothing of it. How do I move that ball forward? When I'm 82 years old in a rocking chair, kind of looking back at much of my life, what do I want to reflect on? The books that I read, the people that I talked to, the ideas that I engaged with, did I effectively mature at an intellectual level? Did I continue to grow and develop? And you could look at that in the same standpoint if you're talking about emotional growth, spiritual growth, and everything else. The book focuses, I mean, our business is the precious metals business. We've done that since 1972. So tangible assets are something we're very familiar with. But what we find in 50 years of being in business is that oftentimes people don't do a very good job of managing the intangibles of their life. So again, you can focus on growing a balance sheet, reducing your debt, increasing your assets, and all of that is well and good. But they forget that they have greater treasure, and that greater treasure is in the relationships that are at their fingertips and the resources they need to make those relationships flourish. So now you're talking about the intangible management of resources. And I think that the basic conclusion of the book is manage a comprehensive balance sheet, not just one that deals with tangibles, not just one that deals with, you know, plant infrastructure, property, shares, ounces, but really look at all that you have and make sure you're pushing the ball down the field a little bit further. And you're going to be able to do that if you're more intentional about what you're setting out to accomplish.
You know, it all sounds great, and I think you obviously have put considerable thought into the topic. Help the 102 million people who are underemployed. There's many folks listening to our voices today who are frustrated. If you look at the numbers, and it really depends on how you slice it, but according to the Fed's latest figures, even they are concerned by the lack of participation, if you will, within our employment. Sure, we've got the lowest unemployment rate in decades, but that's against the backdrop of weak economic growth. There's a lot of people struggling out there who are finding it difficult just to put bread on the table today. Help us to understand how we can also participate in this idea of back engineering a better life.
I think that's very relevant. I mean, first of all, 4.3% as an unemployment rate, what that benefits from is all the jobs created since 2008. Do you realize that 93% of the jobs created that get factored into that U3 unemployment statistic come from a model called the birth-death model? It's literally a statistic which says a certain number of people are going to be born, die, and in that process, that life cycle, there'll be a few people who start businesses and hire people. 93% of the jobs created came from that assumption called the birth-death model. So what is 4.3%? I mean, the reality is when you say that there's better than 100 million people who are underemployed, that 4.3% number does not tell the story of the number of families that are suffering from either unemployment or the stresses and strains of just barely making their months. When you sit down at the table and you've done everything that you can struggling to just put bread on the table, here's what I would say. Your legacy, it doesn't matter counting it in dollars and cents. I'm interested in the quality of the conversation that happens as you sit down with family, the ways in which you open up relationship, because honestly, at the end of the day, it would be nice for everyone to have $1 million, the reality is most people won't. That doesn't mean that they can't have a deeply significant life, an incredibly rich and rewarding set of relationships, which feed them, not only in their hearts and their minds, but feed them in 1,000 other ways. And so I think the great accomplishment of the proverbial breadwinner is if he can move one step beyond putting bread on the table. And stir a conversation, whether it's about economics or politics or God or you name it. What happens at the dinner table, at the breakfast table, is absolutely critical. And it's not just what you put on the table. It's how it's served. It's how you're living your life together as a family unit. And so I guess I'm looking at more of the qualitative aspects of life and less of the quantitative. But to say, look, you don't have to be incredibly rich, wealthy, successful from a financial standpoint to be incredibly rich, wealthy, and successful. Some of the best men I know, some of the most amazing women that I know, you can't count it in balance sheet terms. They're amazing people. Who they are as a single mother, who they are as a single father. I'm thinking of a fireman that I know here in town. His wife died 2 years ago of cancer, and he's raising two boys. This is a remarkable human being. We're not, as a firefighter, it's not like he's making $1 million every year. He can't hire out the help to take care and raise his kids. What an amazing guy. The legacy that he's leaving, one of courage, one of showing up and being present with his family, his boys will take that over $1 million inheritance any day of the week. They don't have their mother. You know who they have? A father who is so steeped in love and commitment to them that their lives are forever impacted and changed. Again, who cares if they have money? They have a father, and they have someone who is deeply investing in them. I guess that's, you know, I'm interested in gold and silver. I'm interested in stacking ounces. I'm interested in growing the physical aspects of a financial portfolio. But I've seen so many people, Chris, who are just miserable with their millions. And having the millions doesn't make them happy. It just gives them that many more widgets to worry over.
You know, it's really well said, and I think so many folks will be able to relate. Wealth can be calculated by many terms, the intangible as well as quantitatively. And so I'm guessing that fatherhood and parenthood is a key theme.
As much as fatherhood is an important topic, and I think it is very relevant, as you said, I think statistics would bear out that there's a major impact when there is not a father figure in the home. I also see the role of grandfather. I mean, in the book, I talk about having spent time with my grandfather growing up. He lived in a different state. I only saw him 6 times in my life. And yet he was a giant in my mind. He was a hero. I couldn't fathom who wins a state championship football game 12 years in a row as a football coach, as a principal of a high school. He's an amazing guy. The impact that he had on literally hundreds and hundreds of young men as they were coming of age in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I got to meet him and spend time with him 6 times, and he was just an absolute hero. And I think of aunts and uncles. Some people, you know, some people aren't in a position in their life where they have kids, and they need to recognize the massive impact that they can have being available, investing in their nieces and nephews. And I think what we, you know, life is sometimes not easy. Life is sometimes not easy. But we have an ability to elevate those around us. And sometimes I think when we focus on what other people need, our needs are automatically taken care of. That, you know, when you talk about the struggle to put bread on the table, when you focus on other people's needs, it's fascinating how yours are automatically taken care of. I can't explain how that happens. I can't explain how it works. But I just think of the role of other people in your lives. Doesn't have to be your kids. Doesn't have to be your kids. It could be you being a good neighbor. And this is so absent today. Depth of relationship is absent. And that's what I'm talking about. Because out of depth of relationship comes emotional maturity, comes the opportunity to grow. And here again, we center back on intangible resources.
And if we could just segue over to the precious metals sector.
Well, the context that I see the metals market in is this. Any bull market, regardless of the asset class, it could be Japanese stocks, it could be Southern California real estate, it could be, I mean, pick the asset class and the time frame. And there's behavior patterns that emerge in a bull market. You have the early stages of a maverick speculator, and not that they're the same, but mavericks or speculators, or insiders, who see something changing and they get on board. The second stage of a bull market is when Wall Street sees enough evidence in that there's something of substance here and they want to capitalize on it. So they create vehicles by which they can personally benefit. And then the last and final phase of a bull market in any asset class is when the man on the street comes into the metals market. And so with that in mind, I see the 2000 to 2011 timeframe as encompassing those first two major sections of a bull market in precious metals. Now, I think we were on the cusp of moving parabolic in 2011, 2012. And, you know, for gold to turn at 1920, there was no chart point that said, here's where it turns. I mean, for the technical analyst, perhaps 2150, 2200, there were points at which there would have been resistance and a normal correction. But a normal correction might have lasted 18 to 24 months. We've had a deliberate knockdown in the price of the metals. And that's fine. What we have not seen, however, is the final conclusion of a bull market in precious metals. You might say, well, that's never going to happen because obviously the price got knocked down. They'll just do it again. People have been inspired to buy stocks instead. And as long as the stock market is sailing, I think you have competition, which can't be beat. You watch the stock market roll over, however, and now people have this big question. I thought the economy was improving. I thought everything was fine. I thought Trump was going to solve every problem in the universe. And all of a sudden, when that's not the case, you've got more of a U.S. buyer, because obviously the rest of the world is already buying gold. You look at the buying statistics and in China and Japan and India, and the first quarter was pretty good. It was only here in the United States where the numbers were punked. U.S. Mint said 50% down. That was the demand in the U.S. for gold and silver here in the U.S. It was dropping by 50% in the first quarter. That's not good. When the stock market rolls over, I think you see a very different U.S. investor sentiment, and you see people driving back into gold again. And I think we are moving very quickly towards that third and final stage of a bull market in gold, where there's a manic movement. Manic, instead of panic out of gold, can you imagine as a gold buyer, panic into gold? I think we are on the cusp of that. You know, by 2020, I think you'll have most of the gold bull market done, which means there's a lot of movement between here and there. Maybe it stretches to 2022. But I think you're talking about a radical shift in the price of gold because of amazing political dysfunctionality here in the United States and because of really dangerous changing relationships in international relations. When we look at what used to be the steady and solid relationships in the Middle East, whether it was Mubarak or Hussein or the Saudi royal family, carpet's been pulled out of every one of those. Every old relationship that we had in Europe is being upended as we speak. I think all of this sets a context for instability. That is a context in which many things can go wrong in the financial markets, which again plays directly into panic buying by investors saying, I got to do something other than continue to take losses in financial assets. So long and the short of it is we've got three stages in a gold bull market. The most exciting one, the one that moves most aggressively to the upside, I think is immediately in front of us.
It's so fortuitous you'd bring this up. A couple of interesting articles this week and discussions, one by John Embry, another Dr. Stephen Lieb, with Bitcoin approaching 3,000, maybe even eclipsing it, who knows. This is just a remarkable theme that's unfolding. And so when you start to talk about potential for a parabolic rise in just 3 years or so in the yellow metal and silver, I think that goes from merely speculation and the world of probability now to a much more likely outcome, maybe just a matter of when instead of whether or not it'll occur. We're seeing signs of bubble and trendy artwork, as I mentioned, the cryptocurrencies, and everywhere except, and this is what Embry brought up, the precious metals. And it's just a bit suspicious. What do you think will be the tipping point in this chaotic system that sends the metals higher?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think the volumes are already increasing in other parts of the world. And so it's really just what gets the attention of a U.S. investor. We're late to the game. And I think you can even create sort of stratas of intelligence in the investment community. I think it's a given that people who understand the fixed income universe are kind of the math. They get things early. Maybe the guys who get things even earlier than that, because they trade in nanosecond time frames, are your currency traders. So those are the smart folks in the room, the stock traders. They tend to love momentum, and they don't really necessarily appreciate where they're at in the larger context. And I don't mean to pick on anyone in particular, but as a class of investors, fixed income folks get it long before the stock investor does. And the guys who have their finger on the pulse of the currency markets, they get it even before the fixed income guys do. So to me, you look at the U.S. investor, and I think the tipping point is the U.S. stock market. You see the Dow lose 2,000-4,000 points. Now all of a sudden people are thinking about gold again. And I say that this is an isolated issue in the United States because, again, demand in China is good. Demand in Japan is good. Demand in India is good. And you know, these are places that are taking down major tonnage. I think what the U.S. investor does not appreciate is how inelastic gold and silver actually are. I know there's some criticism of GLD and SLV and the exchange-traded funds, but the fact of the matter is, in 2013-14, when we had major sell-offs in gold and in those ETFs, better than 800 actual tons of gold went from London to Zurich, Zurich to Shanghai. And that gold's not coming back. When the U.S. investor says, oh, I want the gold that I owned 2007, 8, 9, that I sold out in 13, 14, I want to own it back again. Click of a mouse, I want to buy the ETF. Where do you come up with 800 tons of physical gold? The stuff that was in that fund is sitting in China and it's not coming back. That supply inelasticity, and I think that's where people don't appreciate you can have an exponential move in price to meet an exponential disconnect.
If bullion is what is required to satisfy an investor, things get inelastic in a hurry, and I don't think it takes an economist to realize what happens with an inelastic price chart. Price is irrelevant. We want to produce our cell phones, our computer keyboards, iPhones, computers, all require, you know, minute amounts of gold and silver. Increase of 100% really doesn't impact demand at all. And so really what you're suggesting here is keep an eye on equities, that we have a large bubble there. As I tell people all the time, this bull market, the road is covered with the carcasses of the bears. They've been calling a top since 2010, and here we are in 2017. Do you see anything on the horizon that might scare investors away from equities?
The idea, of course, is that Donald Trump is going to bring about massive amounts of economic growth. And while that is a possibility, the reality of getting anything passed through a very antagonistic legislative process is not that great. It's not that great. So we have big ideas, and we have a stock market that's bumped from 18,000 to 21 and change just since the election. And built into that price structure is a lot of hope and a lot of hype on the basis of what that one man can do. And I think that's where the rub will be, as people come to terms with the fact that they got way out ahead of, in front of themselves. You know, it was hope enough. And it's actually got to be harder to deliver. So I don't know. Is that September, October, by the time reality starts to, maybe people need a summer break to just sit on the beach and think and look at what has not happened since the inauguration and what is likely to be done by the end of the first year. And if it's not looking good, I think maybe they start to hedge their bets a little bit.
There is a precedent for this. If you recall back to, you know, the year 2000, and we saw some euphoria in the markets just as that took place. And of course, we all know how the internet stock bubble ended. It didn't end well at all for equity shares. And it actually was the onset of the precious metals bull that we've seen over the last 16, 17 years or so. So, I mean, it seems as though this is going to, at least according to your metrics and your outlook, to be a rosy 2 or 3, maybe 4 year period ahead. My guess is you see that punctuated by extreme volatility.
I think you're going to see a lot more upside volatility, which is a nice reprieve from what we've had over the last few years. But I think where it's not so rosy is that, you know, again, that period of underperformance in equities from 2000 to, you know, basically 2012, 13, when we finally got across the 12,000 mark on the Dow. And you realize we spent 12 years basically going nowhere. When stocks go nowhere, this goes back to Summers-Barsky thesis, which Larry Summers wrote, I think, in the late 80s. Underperformance of equities generally translates into overperformance of gold and silver. And the paper was actually about gold, but I include silver in it because it's a reasonable assumption to see a trail at least. Gold should do very well in a period of time where stocks don't. And the question is, after 9 years of growth in stocks, which is 2 years more than any long-term growth cycle in the equities markets, can we really expect an encore of another 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 6 years, 7 years of growth in equities? What's the driver of growth? I mean, Chris, you realize the sales cycle for Wall Street, sales trends started going down 2 years ago. So we've had this massive disconnect between the sales of corporate American companies and their share prices. Price-to-sales ratio is the highest it's ever been in history. Takes out the 1929 peak, takes out the year 2000 peak, takes out the year 2007 peak. We're in new territory if you're looking at the sales trends for companies who are moving product, yes, but not as much as they used to. But their share prices have continued to skyrocket. That kind of a disconnect, you know, it's going to be really interesting to watch. We've tried to set up kind of this interesting universe of, yes, we're in the precious metals business. We manage assets, stocks, bonds, and whatnot. And you mentioned the carcasses of bears. We have one of the best bears on staff. He managed the Prudent Bear Mutual Funds for 16 years. He was with Gordy Ringon and Bill Fleckenstein for 9 years as a hedge fund manager before that. And we manage a short product, a tactical short product. And I think it's going to be one of the most exciting things that we've ever done. And our timing, I don't think it'd be any better. We launched it in April. And we're fully functional, having fun, 9% short today, and waiting to get a complete short. But we have the flexibility of if the market goes up 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 points from here, we can get out of the way. Our mandate's loose enough to allow for that. Doug Noland is a brilliant guy. And what we're doing on the short side of the market, I think gold is the easiest way for someone to get the equivalent short in the market without getting fancy. He just said, well, gosh, I don't have $100,000 to invest. Fine. If you've got $5,000 to invest, you should own physical gold. And that's as good as a short as you need in this environment, because you're going to be able to translate that into massive purchasing power on the horizon. But if you can afford to be short, I think this is an intriguing time. It's a very intriguing time to do so. look back at the guys who were doing that in 1929, and there's colleges and universities named after them today. They're remembered because they were going against the trend, not particularly popular at the time, but they called it right.
Sure. I mean, Livermore would absolutely love your thoughts today, among so many others. And John Templeton, you might recall, the late John Templeton, sadly, was almost on this show. We tried for years, but he had moved out of the country, was ill. He, of course, made a great fortune borrowing money, as you'll recall, from friends and family, essentially purchasing up those shares when they were 90 to 100, almost 100% off the original price of the 29 peak prices. So there's always great opportunity there. The only proviso I would toss in here today, as I hope listeners who aren't maybe seasoned investors, maybe professional investors, will keep in mind that this stock market is not going to end abruptly. There's just too much momentum. There's too many forces at play. There's too much mutual fund money flowing in from the sides. And I think we're going to have a few months to watch these markets roll over. So for the typical investor who just wants to maybe bump up some bear funds in their portfolio, who, as you say, don't have the big stockpile, I would encourage people to wait for the trends to change a bit.
It's going to be a significant decline, and you can participate, but let the trend establish itself. Totally agree.
Why don't I give you the floor here, give folks your parting thoughts and any other forward guidance you have for
them. As fun as it is to work in the field, and as much as I've had a love affair with gold and silver since I was probably 6 years old, going to the bank vault with my dad and counting Krugerrands, asking him as a young boy, very impertinently, when you die, can I have all your gold? This is something of an obsession that started early. For all that, there really are more important things in life than money and ounces. And I just, we have the ability, each one of us, to make such a significant difference in the lives of the people around us. And I listened to you tell the story of your friend who 32 years of struggle is now at the pinnacle of his financial success, and yet there's the most important relationships around him that aren't there. And I my very best friend, it's the same story. Three girls and a wife are now a part of his past, and he's racing towards a future of millions and millions and millions of dollars. He'll be infinitely successful. He will be successful. I can't believe it. I can't believe he gave all of that up. Three daughters and a beautiful wife, and for what? Let's keep the real things the real things. Our priorities are priorities. Yes, there's things that you should be doing to move the ball down the field, financially. Getting out of debt is important. Saving is important. Living beneath your means is important, which allows you to do those things. Having gold and silver ounces is important. Building a real estate portfolio is important. But don't forget the intangible resources that you should also be managing. If you're not equally investing time, energy, and thought and care into the relationship with your wife, with your kids, with your distant relatives, this is, in hard times, you know who you need? You need people. You need people. And in difficult times, who are you going to lean on? Have you adequately invested in those spaces? That's where I think we can all take the bull by the horns. You don't have to be a millionaire to be successful. You don't have to leave $1 million to be successful. Your greatest success is going to be measured in the decisions that you make each day, in the legacy that you're creating right now, intentionally designing your life towards your highest goals, expectations, and ideas. This afternoon, I've got to hop in the pool and swim about 2 miles, and I've got a big race coming up at the end of the month, and it's if it doesn't kill me, if I can survive it. Yeah, the reason I mention it is you got to start somewhere, and it's never easy, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes. And with practice, whether it's emotional muscle memory or actual muscle memory, you do get stronger, you do get better, you do get more competent. It's never easy to get started. It's never easy to get started. But once you do, again, there is something to muscle memory. And it's absolutely a part of the deal. If you've never stretched your brain, if you've never stretched the emotional aspects of who you are, of course it's uncomfortable. Absolutely. There's no easy way around it. The good things in life, honestly, none of them come easy. The really good things in life, none of them come easy. And the harder it is, the more you should be committed to it, because you should know that there's something real and substantive there that you're fighting for.
Why don't you tell folks more about the Intentional Legacy, where they can pick up a copy, why they'll want to do so, and perhaps a little bit more about McIlvaney Financial Companies.
Chris, the book's available on Amazon. If you want to look at it there, the Intentional Legacy is the title of it. And, you know, we do a weekly podcast, have for the last 10 years, relating to issues on the economy. You can find our whole universe of offerings if you go to McIlvaney.com. And the last name is spelled McIlvaney.com. That'll take you to a place where you can either dive into our wealth management offerings, our precious metals offerings, which go back to 1972, or, you know, kind of our communication and education offerings, if you will, which would be the weekly commentary and things like that. I think we offer a lot, from Doug Nolan's Credit Bubble Bulletins is now part of our team, to our weekly commentary. My dad's been writing a newsletter for over 40 years dealing with issues in the economy and the financial market as they relate specifically to precious metals. In fact, what I would encourage everyone to do, if you're going to do one thing today, request either online, go to our website and request it, or call our 800 number and request our special report on gold. My dad just spent 100 hours writing a special report on gold, and it's a guy who's got some experience. He's 77 years old. Our company is almost 50 years old, and he's been doing it a long time. And what he's observing living in Asia today, and trends changing both politically and from a capital flow standpoint, I think are pretty important. I'd get a copy of that as sort of a must read. Let me give you the website again, McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And in the request, you know, contact us, that section, request the special report on gold. 800-525-9556. 800-525-9556.
All right, David McIlvaney, any other parting comments? Anything else you'd like to leave with the listeners today?
Chris, just that I appreciate your work, and I appreciate the time that you put into creating an educational format for folks to continue to learn and grow. I mean, that's in essence a lot of what we've been talking about today. This is a conversation that I've had with my kids before. To approach economics and finance, and you're helping people do this, to approach economics and finance, and you're regular commitment and dedication to doing that, whether or not people convey enough appreciation to you, I don't know how often you get feedback, but you're providing a great service. And for people to be able to sit and listen and ponder and shoot you questions, it's just, you're participating in people's growth and maturation and understanding of the financial markets, and that's appreciated. And any of your listeners who want to join us will be meeting with clients, but they are welcome to show up. Thanks, Chris, so much for your time today.
Safe travels. With demand for the yellow metal booming around the world, including China, where we just saw a 50% increase in demand, it's just a pleasure to welcome back Bill Murphy from GATA.org. That's the Gold Antitrust Committee, where he and Chris Powell continue to work on all of our behalves, trying to resolve this market manipulation in the precious metals market. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris.
Great to have you back. Interesting article. Discussion with Paul Craig Roberts, a favorite of ours on the show here, and I'm sure you're familiar with his work. The stance that Bitcoin is actually standing in for gold as an inflation hedge, because they say, the central bankers, they can't short it to infinity, unlike gold and silver, where the powers that be have essentially an infinite amount of ammo to attack the markets. They don't know how to contain Bitcoin. What they're really alluding to here is, inevitably, this is going to be big news for the precious metals. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, a couple. And I think one, it's great to see, and congrats to the people who were smart enough to get involved with Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies. And I think, you know, it's going up to, you know, close to 3,000, for crying out loud. I was at the Acapulco conference with Jeff Berwick, and a lot of Bitcoin people were there, and they were thrilled because it was the same price as gold when it was about 1230. And now here we are still struggling below 1300. Look what Bitcoin has done. And Dave's a smart guy, and he's right. But it also paves the way for what the gold price is going to do once the gold cartel loses control. A perfect example is yesterday. Gold Hunts finally has a really good day, gets close to 1,300. Open interest in the gold arena went up, the COMEX, 27,000 contracts. It's just ludicrous the amount of effort the gold cartel is making to stop gold and silver from doing what they should be doing, and that's trade like Bitcoin.
I admit I'm not an expert on cryptocurrencies, although, and, you know, started mining back in 2009, 2010, just thought it was a neat hobby. Never thought, you know, you could buy nearly 3 gold coins with a Bitcoin. Who knows how long that trend will continue. I'd like to move over to an article by Egon von Greyers. He says that Swiss gold refiners have had all of their gold absorbed by China and India, that China's consumption is expected to increase by leaps and bounds, you know, as that middle-class affluence continues to improve. Folks want to crystallize their wealth. And he's asking then, where else is this gold coming from to cap the markets if the physical is being absorbed as though it weren't even there? He agrees with Gatta. He says it's got to be paper gold. Any thoughts?
Yes, but in addition to paper gold, it's got to be a lot of physical gold coming out of the central banks, because there's a, you know, there's a pricing mechanism every day. It's a London fix. That's the physical price of the day, and it's got to meet demand. So, yes, the paper market is overwhelming other aspects out there like you're bringing up, but still the physical supply has to be hitting the market, too, from someplace. Got to be the central bank. So it's just going to be a mess like this until what I call the gold cartel blows up. And do I think it's coming? Absolutely.
Well, it might be coming sooner than we anticipate. If you take a look at the latest numbers on China now, they're calling for 1,000 metric tons to be absorbed this year. I mean, you're starting to approach the gold reserves of some European country or Venezuela. Just 1 year's consumption. They're also the number one producer and consumer now. They just eclipsed India as far as consumption goes. So there's been a lot of speculation by folks on the show, such as Dr. Stephen Lieb and others. They may be producing numbers that we would find hard to believe. Of course, they don't allow any of that to leave the shores.
That's right. And at some point, out of nowhere, all of a sudden, it's going to be a big deal in terms of affecting the price here. You pile what China's doing on top of what India is now back to doing again. And it's really something. And perhaps it's starting to have its effect now, and why we could had a decent move up in gold of late.
Another story this week, a couple of key strategic states out west have eliminated or are in the process of eliminating at least state-related taxes, allowing gold and silver, or at least encouraging gold and silver to circulate above board, but maybe outside the mainstream. We don't tax dollar bills, but we're taxing real money inordinately. Do you expect this trend to gain momentum, or is this just an anomaly?
Well, I'm not sure where it would gain momentum, quite frankly. And I'm not on top of it maybe as I should be, but anything obviously to lessen the tax load is a positive. And, you know, we have the Indians messing around with stuff like that over there, and it's not a good thing. And hopefully the trend will continue.
You know, just as a side note here, an interesting article on Gatta this week, a hoard of gold coins found part of the Roman Empire about 476 AD in the Netherlands. Apparently it was buried by a Frankish military leader at the time. Just an enormous stockpile, if you will, in an orchard. The value that was stored there over 1,500 years ago remained in that orchard for so long. It's still there. It's static. In some ways, you might say it's even gained tremendous value because of the collectors. That's what we want people to do, is it not? We want for folks to get outside of the crumbling global currency system. Do you expect the U.S. dollar to continue to slide in the coming years? You know, will that malaise eventually be seen throughout all global currencies?
Down technically and completed a massive top formation, and yes, I think it will continue. I mean, we've got some major league problems that nobody seems to want to address lately in terms of what's going on and what it's going to take to cure it. And interestingly enough, I mean, that's what President Trump wants, to help jobs, the lower dollars. I mean, the administration may not say that publicly right now, but he said that way back when, and a good way to help in that regard is to get the dollar down.
This is not scripted. The current administration has just brought in, and I believe confirmed, an economist, a strong advocate of negative interest rates. And of course, that goes hand in hand with your thesis of a weaker dollar. Negative rates does not improve global confidence in your currency. But what is interesting is negative rates is the perfect panacea for the precious metals sector. Okay, anything else on your radar screen before we wrap up today?
Oh, it's just that, you know, what they're doing to silver is ridiculous. You know, the open interest is still way up there, and right from last year, it would be at all-time highs by a pretty good margin, and they're just all over it, and they're just afraid of losing control of it. And their kryptonite, as James McSherley says all the time, and it's true. I think once silver gets to 21, it's going to go bonkers and trade like no market in history. And this has just gone on way too long, too far, and they're all over it right now, but I really do believe we're getting closer and closer to the time when they lose control.
Well, you know, human beings love our stories. I think it gives folks confidence when we can craft and convey a convincing tale. And that's what we try to do here on the show. But at the end of the day, I'm a technician. I like to see what other traders think, and they think with their wallets. What we're seeing carved out here is one of the most spectacularly bullish inverse head and shoulders in gold and silver. The last time I saw anything like that was 2010, and it just took off. I think we're setting up for something like that. For folks that are upset that their silver hasn't run, I'd compare it to some of these cryptocurrencies, the secondary ones. You know, Bitcoin's done really well, but Ethereum has gone from $9. Last time I checked it was like $200 or $300 in just a couple of months' time. You know, silver could go up a factor many fold of that. That's what at least history has shown us. Parting comments.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think when silver takes out 21, it's going to go up much faster than it did in 2010 and 11. So we wait and keep our fingers crossed and keep looking for the move to kick in.
Exactly. No, it's like my family members who were in the military used to say, you hurry up and waiting is the hardest part. That's what we do. You know, sitting on the bench is never fun. We all like to be in the game. And as Gatta says, you've got to be in it to win it. And I think that's just the analogy for what we're doing here. So can you tell us more, please, about what they'll find? Our listeners, they navigate their browsers over to Gatta.org and to La Metropole Cafe.
Well, they can go to, as you said, Gatta.org and get on the free list and Chris Powell takes care of, does a great job, and for myself, LegendfulCafe.com, people can sign up for a 2-week free trial, see if that's of interest.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. When you turn on mainstream media and listen to the rhetoric being espoused, there is no doubt that an unprecedented climate of change exists like never before in our political, financial, educational, and media institutions. The level of discourse and reasoning has deteriorated to levels that rival anything I have seen in my lifetime. The noise has become hysteria. Most Democrats and many Republicans have not hidden their dislike for the Commander-in-Chief. The media has not hidden its dislike. As a result, fake news abounds, not from independent content creators on the web, who are actually being demonetized and shut down through a new form of digital censorship, but rather established mainstream media outlets who have lost control of a managed narrative and are desperately trying to reclaim it. That desperation is pure panther sweat, and it's creating a level of transparency that is enabling more and more people to awaken from their deep slumber, which has been induced by the very institutions that are now in panic mode. Those institutions all seem to be barking like dogs who are sensing the approach of a violent storm that is not yet apparent to most people. What is the nature of that storm? What are they afraid of? Why are they barking? What they are sensing is the approach of an impending disaster that will force every member of the media, Congress, the Fed, and other institutions to take ownership, responsibility, and accountability for 6 decades of borrowing resources and human labor from the future to live today. We saw what the opening salvo of that process looked like in 2008. The rumble and aftershock of that financial event is not over. The expectation is that it will resurface again during this presidential administration. Those who are truly responsible for what is coming are trying in desperation to preemptively shift responsibility for such an event to the current administration. Inaccurate polling, record voter turnout from the silent majority, as in those who haven't voted in some time or don't participate in polls, and an innovative, direct, alternative media of independent content creators comprised of citizen journalists facilitating direct peer-to-peer communication on every conceivable subject. All of these dynamics aligned in a perfect storm and elected a commander-in-chief who, by all accounts, wasn't supposed to win, but did. Never mind the failed campaigns and ineffective attempts to communicate with the public that has already moved on in how they choose to interact and receive information. 16 Republican candidates and 1 Democratic candidate all failed in their messaging and attempts to connect with the public. They were all sore losers, and their perpetuation of an inaccurate narrative disguised as the pursuit of justice, enabling most of them, on all sides of the aisle, to stall on enacting any real change, is dangerous to the well-being of the country. Failed leadership is the real story. With organized paid protesters, conspiracy theories in the mainstream media, and disingenuous political leaders, confidence has already eroded. That loss of confidence in the status quo is unacceptable to those at the helm. Therefore, prepare yourself, because the whining and rhetoric that shrieks from most politicians and mainstream media is here to stay. And if they can't ultimately blame the commander-in-chief, by default, they will blame you. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For 2 new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.